The second case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota versus David J. Asmussen. For the appellant, State of South Dakota, is Mr. Craig Eichstead, an Assistant Attorney General from Pierre. For the appellee, David J. Asmussen, is Mr. Rick Ribstein, an attorney from Brookings. Mr. Eichstead, you may proceed, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, this appeal arises from a constitutional challenge to the South Dakota stalking statute, or at least to one portion of it. This challenge was brought on its face prior to trial. The defendant, David J. Asmussen, was charged with stalking Pamela Dunn in Watertown, Cotting County, South Dakota. For purposes of this appeal, the only facts that we have are those that are alleged in the indictment, because the matter was determined prior to trial. The trial court declared one particular portion of the statute unconstitutional. So at least for purposes of this appeal, the facts should be taken as true as alleged in the indictment. Only count two of the indictment is involved in this appeal. That count alleges that defendant willfully, maliciously, and repeatedly harassed Pamela Dunn by means of a verbal, electronic, mechanical, telegraphic, or written communication, violation of SDCL 22-19 capital A-1 sub 3, and sub 3 is also the only statute that's challenged that's at issue on appeal. Trial court found that this particular subsection of the statute was both unconstitutionally vague as well as overbroad. And as I said, it's only the one statute that's under challenge. But the subsection prohibits anyone from willfully and maliciously and repeatedly harassing another person by means of a communication. And there are several different types of communications that I listed earlier that are in the statute. Besides being limited to those communications that are willful, malicious, and repeated, the statute is also further limited by the fact that harassment is defined as being something that requires a course of conduct which seriously alarms, annoys, or harasses another person. It must be directed at a specific person, and it must serve no legitimate purpose. The course of conduct then is further limited by Section 5 of the chapter to a series of acts over a period of time, however short, evidencing a continuity of purpose, and constitutionally protected activity is specifically excluded. And we would just remind the court at the outset, of course, the statutes are presumed to be constitutional, and they're constitutional unless the contrary is shown beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, the particular challenges that were brought, and that the trial court, in the ways in which the trial court found the statute to be wanting, are vagueness and overbreadth. Vagueness is a concept that arises in U.S. Supreme Court cases, and that this court is also considered under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. To be found vague, a statute must be either so unclear that what is prohibited cannot be perceived by persons of common understanding unless they guess at it, or it must contain no ascertainable standards of enforcement and thus leave enforcement to the whim of police officers. And if the statute is found to be so wanting, it's a violation of due process. Overbreadth, on the other hand, is a doctrine that arises under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution and is basically an exception to the usual rules of standing. It permits a defendant who is not affected, or is at least whose conduct would be prohibited under this statute, to challenge the statute nonetheless because of the fact that the rights of others will be deterred. Others will be deterred from exercising First Amendment freedom of speech and similar rights if the statute stands. And the statute must be such that its very existence deters or stops people from exercising First Amendment freedoms. Those are the two doctrines that are involved. Now, as to the vagueness doctrine, there are standing requirements before it can be asserted. and this court has found, and the U.S. Supreme Court has also found, that a defendant lacks standing to bring a vagueness challenge if his or her conduct is squarely within the statute and that conduct may legally be prohibited by a criminal law. A facial challenge under the vagueness doctrine, at least as we read the cases, and City of Chicago versus Morales is probably the latest one that discusses this, but we would read the cases as saying the facial challenge is permissible only when we're talking about the second type of vagueness, which is arbitrary enforcement because of lack of standards, and then facial challenge is permitted under vagueness only where vagueness also permeates the statute. Now, it's our contention, it's the state's contention in this instance, that the conduct of which the defendant is accused, that is, repeated harassing telephone calls of the nature that is shown, or at least that's alleged in the indictment, is conduct that is at the core of this statute and is not at the outer fringes of it. And because of that, because what he did is something that the legislature could prohibit and clearly did prohibit, he has no standing at this point to raise the matter. Now, it's he must have standing for a facial challenge, because that's what we're talking about here, a challenge of the statute on its face, not as applied to him, since there, to this point, been no fact-finding. It's the state's view that under both of the prongs of the vagueness doctrine that we talked about, this statute passes muster. First of all, as to clarity of what the statute prohibits.
Before you go on there, what about the argument that there's communication, that there are there's fundamental right to communication involved here?
Certainly.
And therefore, standing is appropriate in this case.
We don't really think it's appropriate in this case because of the nature of the communications, and that leads directly to my first argument, because the statute requires that a communication be willful, repeated, and malicious, and particularly with the malicious nature of the communication. If it's something that's done with actual malice, it's not something that's protected by the Constitution. And also, if it's willful, that is, it's not something that's done by accident, we would say that particular mens rea, or that particular mental state, takes it out of the protected category, and of course that's a specific requirement of the statute. And that specific requirement of the statute has been found to be important in those cases, and we've cited cases from Montana, from Oklahoma, and to a lesser extent from Wyoming that have upheld similar statutes that have such a mental state. But in addition to the mental state, these statutes require harassment. They require a course of conduct, which is defined as being multiple times, and not only is it repeated in the first section, but course of conduct is also defined as requiring a series of acts. They must seriously alarm, annoy, or harass the person. They must be directed at a specific person, not at the public at large. They must serve no legitimate purpose, and at the end, constitutionally protected activity is likewise excluded. So it's the state's view that with all of these limitations, the statute is not going to either deter protected communications, nor is it going to reach protected communications. With such limitations, then the statute and what it prohibits becomes clear. Also, if these limitations provide the type of enforcement criteria that are required to keep a statute from being vague. and as the state would argue, this statute is not vague under either of the criteria that have been set out in this court's cases and in the United States Supreme Court cases. It's plain to the state that a person of common understanding would know what is prohibited when it's prohibited that person is prohibited from alarming, annoying, or harassing another. And in fact, this court in State versus McGill the state would contend actually upheld these statutes or these words and said that they had a meaning that could be commonly understood.
Like telling your 12-year-old to quit harassing the dog?
Could be something like that, Your Honor. I think the 12-year-old...
You're saying there's a generic understanding among the public as to what...
Yes, Your Honor.
What these words mean, that these are not legalese that Joe Sixpack out on the street wouldn't understand what they meant.
I would say so, Your Honor, and that's particularly important where we're talking about a person of common understanding, because that's what the cases all call for. And we'd also say that a person of common understanding would understand what a repeated commission of the acts would mean. These mental states of willful and malicious, they have common understandings, but they also have definitions. And as we said, harass, annoy, alarm, those things all have common definitions that people of ordinary understanding would know about, and that would take us out of that first criterion. And these things also provide ascertainable standards for enforcement so that they won't be applied to a lot of things that are not, that they ought not to be applied to and will not be applied to protected activity. The statute also does not come, in the state's view, under the overbreadth doctrine. It is not overbroad. We recognize, of course, that the U.S. Supreme Court cases, and to a lesser extent this court's cases, see the overbreadth doctrine as basically an exception to standing rules. But if the overbreadth doctrine does not apply, then the defendant lacks standing here, as he did with the first issue. We need to remember that under Broderick versus Oklahoma and also the other cases that are cited, the overbreadth doctrine is very strong medicine to be applied sparingly and to be done so in a way that will not prohibit the legislature from adopting ordinary criminal laws that regulate conduct needs to be regulated. This doctrine does not apply to this specific statute for several reasons. First of all, there's the overall presumption of constitutionality that the court always has. Overbreadth, as I previously indicated, is strong medicine. It should be used sparingly. The very existence of the statute must be a significant deterrent to freedom of expression before it will be found to be overbroad. And finally, where conduct as well as pure speech is prohibited by a statute, the overbreadth of the statute must be not only real, but also must be substantial in relation to the legitimate sweep of the statute. And this statute has a legitimate sweep because it attempts to prohibit the harassment of those who, for whatever reason, the defendant might have a dispute with, might wish to get at, and it's in the overall view or generic category of a stalking statute, which is something that's very important at this point in time.
There's not any language in here about a dispute, however, is
yeah,
there?
That's correct, Your Honor. I misspoke there. I'd say what the statute really seeks to prohibit is harassment of another individual, harassment directed at that specific person, and having a course of conduct and not involving constitutionally protected activity.
It isn't the problem here with the statute, is it that the legislature took out the reasonable person standard on the person that is being the specific person, which is the object of the statute and the definition of harass, or seriously alarms, annoys, or harasses that person, it doesn't have a reasonable person standard. So it's a subjective standard, and isn't that the problem?
That would be the problem. Some other courts have found it, Your Honor, but I think the defendant has cited some cases in Kansas and Colorado. But on the other hand, as long as there's a mens rea element, including the malicious and willful, other courts, including those in Montana and Oklahoma specifically, have found that such statutes may be upheld. Now,
but haven't they also had language about reasonable fear, reasonable
I don't believe that the Montana and Oklahoma courts have, and we also, based on what the defendant did in our reply brief, we looked through all the statutes of the 50 states, and I believe we've listed several there that seem to have part of the statute that has a reasonable person standard, which South Dakota has, and part of it that doesn't, and specifically it's sub 3 that doesn't have. And the other states seem to also, some of the other states seem to also have that, and some of those statutes have been upheld.
But in those cases, if I'm remembering correctly, the courts had imposed the reasonable person standard. And how can we do that when our legislature has taken it out?
Well, I think you need to look at, to answer the question directly, the legislative history shouldn't be considered unless the statute's ambiguous and both sides say that it's not ambiguous. But to go beyond that as to what these other courts say, I believe the Oklahoma court did not necessarily impose the reasonable doubt standard. The Maryland court in Galloway did. Montana didn't talk about it specifically, but seemed to use the reasonable doubt standard in an overall sense, even though the statute didn't necessarily require it. Now, as to the legislature having taken it out, I guess it's the state's view that the statute stands as it is and ought to be interpreted as it is. And possibly a counter-argument to that would be that although it took out the reasonable doubt standard, the legislature left in a prohibition or something saying that this statute does not apply to constitutionally protected conduct. And it would be our view that if the legislature indicates an intent in the present language of the statute, have it not apply to constitutionally protected conduct, if the court needs to impose a reasonable doubt standard or do something else by way of interpretation that would allow for that, that would allow that is for it to not be applied to constitutionally protected conduct, then the court should do that by means of interpretation. But it would seem that you're correct, Justice Meyer-Henry, in that if the reasonable doubt standard were still there, there would be little or no controversy involved. But on the other hand, as I said, still think that with the limitations that are present, the statute is still unconstitutional, or still constitutional, misspoke, based on the fact that it has all of the other limitations that it does have. And we would
don't you think that when you incorporate the definition of harasses, and that includes conduct which means a knowing and willful course of conduct directed at a specific person which seriously alarms, annoys, or harasses the person, don't you think that even though the reasonable fear element was taken out earlier, doesn't that really put it back in?
It certainly puts in the subjective standard, and I think you could argue that it's also an objective standard simply because we're talking about seriously. And maybe serious could be subjective, but on the other hand, you could think of it as being an objective type of thing. And the fact that it's limited to a specific person, I think, is important as well. And the fact that it must be done willfully and maliciously is important. But the fact that one must substantially harass them, I think that could possibly have that interpretation, yes.
If the claim is right that the reasonable fear has been removed, then what would the statute have to have? Would it have to say at a specific person which seriously and reasonably alarms, annoys, or harasses the person?
Something like that, Your Honor. That's correct. That would do it, I think, and there's language all over the board in these various statutes. A lot of them have something like that, or might say something like would put a reasonable person in fear of, you know, whatever, or something like that. That's the general language that's found in a lot of these statutes.
Are the cases which say that it's, you know, when you've got language like this, it's implied even if it's not expressly inserted in there?
We would cite the Maryland versus Galloway case that says something like that. Montana seems to apply it without actually saying so. There are some others that have done so, but in several of the statutes that we've found, I don't think there's a controlling decision that's done it. But yes, there are a couple of states that have done that we've cited in the brief.
If that's so, could the trial court save this? If there is a problem with it, could it save it by a jury instruction or not? Or is this not something that can be saved by a jury?
I would say that if it's interpreted, Your Honor, to include the reasonable doubt thing, then you could do it with a jury instruction, and that would tell the jury that they would need to find the reasonable fear. And if that was in there, that would I think that would do it, yes.
Thank you, Counselor. Your time has expired. Excuse me. Mr. Ripstein, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel.
Whoops.
My name is Rick Ripstein. I'm here on behalf of the defendant, Dave Osmussen, in this matter on the appeal from the Third Circuit, Judge Tim presiding on that matter. Mr. Eichstedt has gone through a number of different standards and elements based upon the vagueness and overbroad portion of the prong. We do not have a great deal of facts. In fact, we have very few facts to present to the court in this matter. The state has referred to different states, including Oklahoma, and I believe Montana, in its argument. And if the court does go back to those cases, I believe on page 4 of their brief, and if you look at those cases, they do discuss the reasonable person standard. In fact, Oklahoma, if you look at their statute now, they have again incorporated the reasonable person standard back into their
language. Don't all statutes though really imply a reasonable standard, a reasonable person? We've got tort statutes. It doesn't have the magic words in there, and we imply it. We have contract statutes. Again, implies good faith. I mean, isn't that ingrained in our law just about everywhere?
Well, I think that may depend on some of the legislative history. The state has cited Galloway v. Maryland. Their history lacks what our state has for the legislative history going back to 1992 when they implemented the statute. They did have the reasonable person standard at that point in time, and as we know, in 1993 that was redacted or taken out along with some of the other language.
Any insight as to why our legislature would tinker with the statute and remove that language when apparently it was all part of a model act enacted by many, many states around the country?
Right. That's a good question. I thought through that. The concern there is they are essentially stepping back and looking at protection, and they're taking that big net that the cases talk about and throwing it over all offenders, and then basically throwing it in front of the court to say, well, we removed that language, we think it's now constitutional, and we put a sentence in there to really say it is constitutional. But then they're stepping into this court basically trying to help you make a decision that you have to make on your own. But why they took it out, I'm not sure, because now we have, I believe, 4 states, Arkansas, Nebraska, Minnesota, and South Dakota, that have statutes similar to ours, and I believe Minnesota changed theirs in 97. They have not yet been challenged.
Intent to make it subjective? I mean, was that the reason they didn't change it, do you think?
That's possible, but the concern then gets back to each individual person. You know, how does it affect a particular person? It affects one person or annoys one person different in a different way than it does the other person. But if that was truly their intent, then it's stepping away from the objective standard that we really need to analyze and look at statutes such as this.
Well, then, if you took that argument to its logical conclusion, you would conclude the legislature wanted to accommodate the so-called eggshell complainant that we wouldn't think was a reasonable complaint, but they, for whatever reason, do, and that the legislature is now saying that this is even entitled to protection under the statute. Does that cause you concern as far as your interpretation of subjective views versus objective reasonable?
You know, that really gets back to how we look at the arbitrary enforcement of this. That gives police officers and prosecutors no guidance, and they're back to subjective point of view also. How do we analyze each case? And I can only really kind of think of a hypothetical, since we don't have any facts before the case. When it comes back to that subjectiveness or how it affects a particular person, and I've been trying to think through different factual scenarios here, but if we have, for example, a young lady that goes into one of these places where they have these high interest rate loans, and she takes out a loan, and the person who works there, his job is subject to collecting that loan. After the time comes up, she hasn't paid it, he starts calling her by phone communication and says, "Ma'am, your note is due today." And she says, "Yeah, I'll get it to you. Each day thereafter, she hasn't paid, he continues to call her to the point where he's calling 3 times a day, 5 times a day, 10 times a day, saying, "I need that or I'm going to lose my job, so you need to get that money in here." She doesn't get it in there. He gets to a point where he's going to be fired. He goes and makes more telephone calls to the point where she feels she's being harassed. And in addition, one morning he waits at her house, follows her in his vehicle, where he's following her in her vehicle to work, and she gets out of the vehicle and he says, "I need that money today or something's going to happen. You know, I'm going to go to your husband. We're going to get it some way, shape, or form here." Well, initially he's got a legitimate purpose in contacting her to get the loan paid back. So where do we draw the line? And she is to a point where she feels she's being harassed, as I mentioned. So what does she do? She goes to maybe a local police officer and says, "Here's where we're at on this deal. I borrowed some money. I haven't paid it back. He started calling me at work. It's up to 3, 4, 5, 6 times a day. Now he's harassing me. He's even mentioned my husband, or he said something bad is gonna happen." So from the point of view of her subjectiveness, she feels like she's being harassed, and the police officer then, as the enforcer of this, is going to have to look at that scenario to say, does this fall within the statute? His partner might look at this and say, "Well, come on, this is a civil thing." But to her, they have to look at her and her emotions and her status.
But isn't that exactly the kind of constitutionally protected conduct that the legislature is accepting out of the statute?
Well, when I look at that sentence that's in the statute, I mean, it says what it says, but to me that's somewhat of a red herring. We already know, that statement. But it gets to the point where it doesn't solve the problem. We still have the reasonableness. We still have that standard we have to go back to of a reasonable person.
How would the police officer determine when they're out there to arrest whether or not it's a constitutionally protected activity?
As far as what's reasonable from their standpoint?
Well, I don't know. How would they know? I mean, if this is what the statute says, it's constitutional protected activity would not fall within that statute. Is that a specific enough term to give guidance to the officer to determine who's broken the law and who has not, and who should be arrested?
Well, if you look back at most of the states and the states that have used reasonable person standard, that has been the standard. I don't know how they can pinpoint from one side to another. If you look under the Vagueness, first prong of the Vagueness Doctrine, it's how does a person of ordinary intelligence determine on one side what's lawful and on the other side what's unlawful. But it comes right back to the same argument of arbitrary enforcement, and I don't know how officers draw the line or how they make that determination.
Can we look at the statute as the state's suggesting and impose the reasonable person standard in the statute in order to save it constitutionally?
I do not believe so, and the reason for that, they again cited Galloway v. Maryland, That, as far as looking at Maryland, they do not have the legislative history that we do. I think that gives the court some guidance as to going back from 92 to 94 to 97 up through 2001, the changes that were made. But if it's so vague, I don't think the court can go back and impute or imply that there is a reasonable person standard. That gets back to judicial legislation. And why shouldn't the legislature be the one to do that? Is it simpler to send this back, or affirm and send this back to the legislature and say, we need some guidance? We're taking on your role of trying to interpret what your statute says, and that shouldn't be our role. That should be the legislature to fix what's broken here. I kind of look at this as the Humpty Dumpty theory. If it's broken, you can't put it back together again.
Do you agree that that if the definition of harass is here, which is incorporated into the statute, if it said at a specific person which reasonably and seriously alarms, annoys, or harasses the person, that would fix your constitutional claim?
I believe that would take us back to 1992, where based upon our research, that would have been constitutional if that language is placed back in as far as a reasonable person standard.
Okay. Are there other ways, other minor ways of doing it the same way? I mean, they could inject reasonably into the statute in several different places, or they could insert the word objectively and seriously alarms, annoys, and harasses, right?
Correct.
So any word that implies a reasonable man standard. Do you agree that the word seriously includes a reasonable man standard?
I don't think the word in and of itself seriously would. Then you're getting back to interpreting another word as far as what seriously means. But we didn't find or couldn't find any statutes or language in cases that basically refer to what you're talking to of what if we think outside the box and say, what if we do this, what if we do that? And we really couldn't find anything other than they all referred to the reasonable person standard. And I don't think the state has offered anything either as far as something in the alternative.
Do you think it's a permissible practice for the trial court to correct the problem by saying, however, it must be a reasonable fear, it can't just be seriously serious alarm, serious annoyment, or harassment? It's got to be seriously and reasonable.
I believe probably what happened in this case is Judge Tim did his research, went back to the legislative history, and marched through that to see what changes were made. It's an assumption, but I assume that he felt that the statute now as it is has been so stripped that he could not give an instruction to fix what's been broken. And that's, I think, essentially why he felt it was vague and overbroad. I suppose it's possible.
Even if you were to give an instruction, once it got to that point in the judicial process, would that still solve the second prong of the vagueness issue of not encouraging arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement?
If you were to give an instruction?
Would the instruction alone solve the vagueness issue as far as the enforcement and discriminatory enforcement of the statute?
Again, I apologize for going back to the same point here, but that essentially gets the trial court in a position where they're making a law or they're putting language in that the legislature should really be considering. It's back to judicial legislation again. It's stepping across the line and trying to do what's right, and that's certainly something we can understand, that the trial court would like to save this by giving an instruction, but I think you can only step so far, and when the line is there, I just think you have to send it back to the legislature to say fix it.
But let me just ask you this question on the, if this court were to determine that the third provision in the stalking statute was unconstitutional for the reasons that you've cited, what does that do to the civil protection order process?
As far as anything under 2510, mm-hmm. under the protection order?
Because it refers to this statute on this on the stalking.
Right. See, that's interesting. And in our research, you have 2510. You can have a person who brings a petition under 2510. This is really the nightmare that's been, I guess, created for some of the trial judges. There's so many people coming in on protection orders, and the judge is listening to each factual scenario and granting protection orders. And now under 2219A1, individual can come in for a petition on that as well. So the issue is, can you bootstrap under 2510? Do you go with 2219A? I don't know.
But could it be used for the civil protection order process and be unconstitutional for purposes of the criminal statute? Is it still safe for purposes of the civil protection order requests under a stalking protection order request?
Right. That's a very good question. I don't recall seeing any of the civil statutes that really address the issue of a reasonable person standard. So that's a very good question.
So it still may be possible then to have it be effective as far as the civil protection order process, but not in the criminal.
I think that would bring rise to an appeal to see where we'd go with that that issue. I'm sure it hasn't been addressed yet, but that's typically the way most of the protection order start is under 2510. So that I'm sure will be addressed at some point in time. The state also addressed some of the other issues of standing, and there are numerous U.S. Supreme Court cases and state cases that have upheld standing in cases similar to this. We cited Colander, and if you also go to the City of Las Vegas versus the 8th Judicial Circuit, it gets back to the same analysis of the First and 14th Amendment for the over breadth argument, back to the same points of the vagueness of the notice and the arbitrary enforcement of each of the statutes. But we do believe that our client has standing, not only for himself, but others who may be affected by this statute. But the main point, I guess, we want to make is, no matter how we circle the wagon on this issue, it still gets us back to the reasonable person standard. And you'll see as you go through each of the cases in each of the states other than Arkansas and Nebraska, Minnesota, who have taken the language out, there are some states that have taken it out and have not put it back in based upon the same type of challenges that are here before the court today. Kansas v. Bryan, that's a case pretty much on all fours here. It's the same factual scenario. In fact, it's that interpreted the same type of issues that are before this court today, and they got back to the same premise, reasonable person standard. Just opens everything up for challenge. But I think if you look at Kansas v. Bryan, that's a case that gives some guidance to the issues involved here. What we would essentially ask is that the court affirm the trial court decision. The analysis is the same as what I assume Judge Tim went through to find that it was vague and overbroad. We have kind of discussed the limiting construction, but that gets back again to judicial legislation. We know where to draw the line. It's just, it's appropriate for the legislature to go back and answer their own question, why did we take that language out of the statute? Why did we redact and delete certain elements, opening this up to challenge? We would ask you to affirm the trial court's decision. The statute is broken as it stands. We take it back to the 1992 status. We believe it would be constitutional by putting that language back into the statute.
Is there a case in the last 10 years that says that, you know, normalcy implies the objective, not the subjective, that the subjective is never presumed? That you always imply the reasonable person standard? Isn't there a case like that in the last 10 years?
As far as where they implement and look at the subjective?
Yes.
Not that I can think of offhand. I mean, you look at Pullman, that dealt directly with the instruction intent between sub 1 and sub 2. I guess I can't think of any right offhand that did address that issue.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Eggsted, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I don't know the answer to your last question either, Justice Sabers, as to whether there is such a case that the objective is always presumed. I didn't find it in my research. It may be there. Let's look at it. I just wanted to address a couple of things that the defense counsel talked about. I think that first the example of a loan collector, there are a couple of things about that. First of all, maybe it's constitutionally protected to an extent to carry out one's business, but I would submit that there is a point beyond which even a loan collector could not go, where it would become willful and malicious harassment, where it would seriously annoy and harass the person, so that the fact that it might eventually apply to some loan collector, I don't think should really be what constitutes the determining factor here. The other point is what police can do to determine some objective standard that they may be able to apply. Well, there are a couple of things they can do. I'm sure that that they have instruction at the police academy that would tell them these types of things. They can always talk to the prosecutor, the state's attorney, if they've got some question about a constitutional issue. But there are other limits here as well, including the mental state of the defendant, which is a frequent limit that needs to be applied by police and prosecutors all the time. The fact that this must seriously harass or annoy the person who is involved, the victim, that is something that I think that is certainly something that the police can look at when they're doing this. Point is, there are quite a number of limitations here, and it's not just that it would be applied to everything that someone might say or every time that someone speaks. We would further argue that there is no standing here, as I stated previously, because under the U.S. Supreme Court cases, for there to be standing on vagueness, the vagueness must permeate the statute, and we're only talking about the arbitrary enforcement prong, not about the lack of clarity in the statute itself. The state's view, or the bottom line on this matter, is that the statute, as it's written, is limited, and it's limited in all the ways that previously were outlined. It is not something that could be applied readily to constitutionally protected activity or to ordinary speech. It has the limits on it that are necessary to be upheld, and in fact, a lot of the terms this court recognized in the McGill case are in fact terms that this court has seen as having common everyday meanings, and it is the ability of the common everyday person to be able to understand what's prohibited that's critical as to the first criterion of vagueness. We could look also at the cases that are involved. Mr. Ripstein said that Oklahoma has a reasonable person standard. Well, I don't believe that's true as to part of their statute. They may have discussed it in the case, but there are other courts out there that have upheld similar statutes based on the fact that they are understandable, that they are sufficiently limited, and that they're not so overbroad that they would deter constitutionally protected activity. Based on that fact, and on the fact that this court presumes statutes to be constitutional, and that the court also can, if necessary, put the gloss of the reasonable person standard on this statute, if necessary to save it, and if necessary to carry out the legislature's obvious intent that this should not apply to constitutionally protected activity. Based on all those factors, plus the other arguments in our brief and here previously, we'd ask that Judge Tim's finding that this statute is unconstitutional on its face be reversed and the matter be returned to the circuit court for trial.
Let me ask you this then. If we were to interpret it with the reasonable person standard, how does that affect the civil protection order process? That also then apply to that? Or would it only apply to the civil?
I would assume, and I'm not terribly familiar with it, but if it's as you described, Justice Meyer-Henry apparently incorporates the standard, which I assume it does,
right.
I suspect the reasonable person standard would apply, yes. That would go into whether or not the protection order was granted.
Yeah. Any further questions for Mr. Eichstead? If not, thank you, Mr. Eichstead.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court will be in recess until 11 o'clock.